Thanks always for coming. And because I'll be telling you about some of my research on high rate error correcting code. This is joint work with some of my co-authors. So this is Swastik Kopati, he's another faculty member here also at Rutgers, Or Melian, and who's in Israel at Haifa University, Noga Ronzelli, who was a postdoc here a couple of years ago, and Sergey Lukanin, who was a researcher at Microsoft Research. Okay, so let me motivate the question. Okay, so let's imagine a setting where you have a lot of information and you want to store it. So before I talk, please feel free to ask lots of questions, slow me down, and don't feel shy to interrupt. So let's imagine a setting where we have a great deal of information, which you might want to either store on a DVD or a data center, or you have information you're communicating over a cell phone network, for instance. And in most of these scenarios, the channel or the medium where you're storing the data is noisy. So you might store the data, for instance, and you might store it on a DVD, but the DVD might get a scratch. Or you might try to communicate it over some channel, and there might be circumstances which introduce some noise into the data that you're storing or communicating. And in most settings, reliability of your data is critical. You might store your data, and even a tiny amount of noise or a tiny perturbation might completely alter the meaning of what you're trying to convey. So we cannot afford, let's imagine that we're in a scenario where we cannot afford to have any noise at all. So how do we deal with this? The fact that you have data which you need to keep accurate, and at the same time, wherever you're storing it or transmitting it, some noise is going to get introduced. And Shannon came up with a very beautiful solution to this problem. He said, instead of taking the data and storing it as is on your DVD or communicating it as is, let's first take this data and encode it via an error correcting code. I'll tell you what this is. You take your data, you first encode it, you introduce some kind of redundancy with it. Then you store it. Then this whatever you stored might get subject to some noise. Fine, so now you have some, you have this noisy stored data, and then you run it through a decoding algorithm or a decoder, and at the end of it, hopefully you've recovered your true uncorrupted message. So that's the proposed plan, and this actually works. One can implement a strategy like this, and I'll talk about it. And the great news is you can do something like this and protect against it. Significant number of errors, not just one or two errors, but even if maybe 5% of your data gets corrupted in some adversarial manner, you can still hope to recover the true underlying uncorrupted message. So let me formally define what an error correcting code is. So you have some underlying alphabet. Now you can think of the alphabet to just be just bits, so Z, the 0-1 alphabet. You can think of symbols over a finite field. For those of you who've seen things like that, so integers mod p, those could be members of your alphabet, the English alphabet, whatever. So you pick any alphabet. And the, your code, the main thing underlying it is an encoding map, a way which, where you can take your data and encode it into a code. So you don't take your data and store it as is, you'll first encode it, get a code word and store that. So the code word you obtain via this encoding map, which blows up your message, your data, which might be k symbols long. It will blow it up into a code word, which is something like n symbols long. Think of n to be bigger than k. And blew up your data into a code word, and that's what you're going to store. So the underlying code is the image of this map. So look at all possible messages, transform all of them into code words, and all the things you could have gotten, that's your code. Okay, so each. So if you take a message and you encode it, you get a code word. The code word is n symbols long. So you can think of each code word to be a point in this space, sigma to the n. Okay, so sigma to the n is just a set of all strings of length n over sigma. So each code word is an element of sigma to the n. How many code words do we have in sigma to the n? Sigma to the k. total number of messages.
N is greater than K?
N is greater than K. Think of, for now, think of N to be, say, 2K. The total number for each string of length K could depict some message. And then you're going to encode it. The total number of messages is the total number of strings of length K. So K and N are all going to be parameters. We will set them later on. But the total number of strings of length K is the size of this alphabet to the K. Each string got mapped to some code word. So we have sigma to the K points sitting inside sigma to the N. That's, those are the code words or the underlying code. So that's how, so an encoding map gave you, this code, some parameters that we care about of this underlying code. One is the rate of the code, which is the ratio of K and N. This measures how much redundancy you're introducing into the code word. Okay, so N was 2K, the rate is half. So the closer the rate is to 1, the less redundancy you introduce into your code. And N could be, the rate is small, and N is a big function of K. Okay, so that's one parameter. Another very interesting parameter is the distance of the code. Okay, so what is the distance of the code? I'll say, the code has distance delta, so think of delta say to be 0.1. I'll say the code has distance 0.1. If any two code words differ in Hamming distance or differ in at least 0.1 fraction of the coordinates. So if I take two code words and I write them down as strings, in delta fraction of the locations, their values will be different. If this happens for every pair of code words, every pair of code words has distance delta, I say the overall the code has distance delta. And this distance is a very important parameter because here is the, if the code has good distance, so if every two code words are far apart, then the following nice thing happens. Okay, so you took your data, so what was the Shannon architecture? You took your data, you encoded it into a code word, and then that's the code word is what you're going to store on the DBT. The data, you store it, store this code word. And then some noise got introduced, right? The DBT got a scratch. So when some noise gets introduced, some symbols of the code get flipped to become other symbols of the code. So you start with a code word, and what you end up with is some other word, R. After the noise got introduced, what was written on the DBT maybe 1 year later was not a true code word, but was some other word, R. Which was a true code word with some bits flipped. Now, if the amount of noise isn't too much, then this received word R is going to be pretty close to this code word it came from. And if this code has large distance, means every two code words are pretty far apart. So if you look at this received word, since every two code words are pretty far apart, you can basically look and say, okay, this must have come from here. Won't get confused because any two code words are pretty far apart. And that's why you want the code to have this is. Because if I know that at most 1% fraction of errors occurred, then I can look at my received word and look at a small ball around it. And there will be at most one code word which sits in the small ball around it. Because any two code words are really far apart, two won't fit in this ball. So when I look at a small ball around it, there will be a unique true code word that lies in this ball. Yes.
If error is more in the data and this R is like pretty near to some other encoded,
then there's no hope. Yeah, good. So the error is good. So the error rate is too high, then there's going to be no hope. So there's only hope. The only hope of recovering this true code word is once you look at the received word, I shouldn't get confused about where it came from. And so the amount of error I can tolerate is at most half the distance of the code.
This kind of way really, but how do you know if the how big the error is, like
good
in
question.
Real world.
So one could study that also, testing how much error is there. If you start with this code word, and I put in so much error that I could have hopped to this code word, then I don't really, then there's no hope of knowing what I've written. So basically these codes will have, if there's a big flash of lightning and the data is completely altered and you have no idea what it came from, then probably there's no hope of figuring it out. But if the amount of error is not too much, so for instance, you take your data, you write it on the CD is completely destroyed. There's no way you're going to figure out the original data or what it was. But if the error is not too much, at most 10% of the DVD is corrupt, then you have some upper bound on how much corruption is going to happen, then we can hope to recover the data. In this case, if the distance was delta, and at most delta over 2 fraction of errors occurred, then you can hope to recover the true uncorrupted data. Because when you look at the receiver, there will be the unique closest code word to it when you look at the ball around it. And then there's a decoding problem. Given this, find what this is. There's an algorithmic question underlying it. Given this corrupted code word, find the closest true code word to it. And that's the decoding problem.
Yes. So if error is near to some other point and your decoding algorithm has recovered the data to that point, then there would be a false positive, right?
False. You get some false error, right? So in case the amount of error is too much, then this algorithm might give a false answer. So the only hope of, if you want to guarantee success, you can only do it if the amount of error is not high.
So the Hamming distance is almost like an infinity metric, is that what it is?
Yes.
So what are there other kind of metrics that being used in there, or is this like more of the...
This is the most popular one because we have 0-1 bits. I mean, typically when the errors occur, bits get flipped or not flipped. But I guess people do study things like patterns of errors. Maybe when an error occurs, errors occur in bursts, or when a bit gets flipped, it's very unlikely that the bit next to it is flipped. And so
question really is like, because I think when you think about packing stuff inside another space,
right?
It seems like our infinity would give you a reasonably good packing, but I wonder for different types of spaces that you have different types of packing. I'm not sure.
Right. For instance, people talk about in Euclidean space, how do you pack the maximum number of balls which are disjoint? And that's a very, very, very well studied question. At least in this coding theory, when you're thinking of bits being sent, it makes sense to think over L infinity. And then this is a packing problem. Exactly. What are the two parameters you care about? The distance and the rate. You want the rate to be not too high. Because the more the rate is, the more amount of space you're wasting. I want to only store k bits. If n is going to be huge, then I'm wasting resources. So you want the rate to be as high as possible. And you want the distance to be as large as possible. But the more the distance, the more errors you can tolerate.
As long as people are hammering away at this topic, I should also mention that Shubhangi has also done work dealing with a situation when the error is so big that unique decoding is not possible. And there, frequently, you can still get useful information. There's this whole area called list decoding, which has found a lot of applications. But that's not the topic for today.
Thanks, Eric. And that's a good point. So people have studied scenarios in which the amount of error could be more than half the distance of the code, and in which case it may not be possible to uniquely recover a true code word, but you'll know that, okay, the true code word must be one of these 5 or 10 possibilities. And then maybe you have some other side information to prune it down. So one can also study those scenarios and you return a list of code words, that's list decoding. For now, let's focus on unique decoding. Okay, so there's a big combinatorial question underlying it. Construct the best error correcting codes, which have the best trade-off between rate and distance. And that is exactly this packing problem, which is how many points can you pack in sigma tn so that any two are far apart? What's the best way to construct points? And we understand it pretty well, but we don't really fully understand this packing question either. If I want any two code words to be 0.1 n apart, what's the best way of packing the points in? So that's a very interesting question. Again, I won't focus so much on that. But yes, this is still a big open question. Design the best possible error correcting codes, the best trade-off between rate and distance. And the algorithmic question underlying it is, given an error correcting code, and find a good error correcting code which also has support sufficient algorithms. So there are two algorithms. One is the encoding algorithm. Given the data, how do you compute the code word? And often the trickier question is, given a corrupted code word. So you take a code word and you introduce some errors into it. From the corrupted code word, recover what the original true code word is. So given the corrupted code word, you can search in this ball around it and find the closest point to it. And if you do it by some brute force algorithm, it's exponential time. But maybe if your code is nice in certain ways, you can hope to do it much more efficiently than exponential time. And again, there's different models. Your errors that you're introducing in your code could be worst case errors. So 0.1 n locations are adversarially corrupted. Or you can put a model of random errors. There's certain locations that are randomly corrupted. And both models have been pretty well studied. We'll focus for now on worst case errors. We have no assumption of how these errors are introduced. So here is a really toy example of an error correcting code. Okay? So a very, very basic code, which is a repetition code. I have my message, which is just say four symbols now, x1, x2, x3, x4. Here's a way of reducing redundancy into the code, so that even if there are errors, you can recover the true message. You just take each coordinate and repeat it three times. Now, if someone, if an adversary comes and corrupts one of these symbols on the right, it should be an easy exercise to see how one can recover the true message even after one corruption has occurred. Everyone see how to do that? Right?
Yeah.
Good. So you can probably generalize this to two errors. If you have two errors being corrupted, two errors out here, I can take every symbol and repeat it five times. That would work. But this code has really poor rate distance trade-offs. It's a good start to see that it is possible to store data so that even after corruptions, one can recover the true message, but it's really, really inefficient. People can do much, much better now. If you want to really correct from a constant fraction of corruptions, people can do much better. Here is a classical code, very, very well studied and actually widely used in practice. So let me just already give you an example of a really elegant, non-trivial family of codes. These are codes based on polynomials. It's called the Reed-Solomon family of codes. And so let me say about this. So let F be a finite field. Okay, so for those of you who don't like finite fields, think of integers modulo a prime. Okay, so pick a large prime number and look at everything. Everything you're doing is mod that prime. Pick a large field and your alphabet is elements from this finite field. In real coding theory, when you want to do it in practice, maybe you prefer bits, zeros and ones. So all this can be eventually converted to bits. But for now, let's work over this finite field. Later, we can convert it to bits. And now you pick n distinct elements of your field. If your integer is mod of prime, just 1, 2, 3 up to n could be the n elements in your finite field. Your message, our code was going to take messages of length k and encode it into code words of length n. You can take any message of length k. So let me just, I can manage without. So you take any message of length k. Any message of length k is a string of k symbols in your alphabet. You can treat this string of k symbols to be the coefficients of a degree k minus 1 polynomial. A degree k minus 1 univariate. A degree k minus 1 univariate polynomial, for instance, ak minus 1, x to the k minus 1, ak minus 2. So if I have this string, if I have some string of length k, I can just take this string and interpret it as a polynomial. I just interpret it as a polynomial. I just think. That's my message. I view it as a polynomial. And the encoding of this polynomial, the way I take my message and get a code word, is I take this polynomial and I evaluate it at my n distinct choice of letters was bad. It is there, so let these be bees. This was my message. And so I started the message and I interpret it as a polynomial, and the way I encode it is I take this polynomial and I evaluate it at a1, a2, a3 up to an. So each time I evaluate the polynomial at a1, I get a symbol. I evaluate the polynomial at a2, I get a symbol. So these, all these evaluations give me n symbols and I write them down as a string. So this is some polynomial p sub of x. I write down p sub d of e1, p sub d of e2, p sub d of a. I write down the string of n symbols. Yes.
So what's the relation between k and n?
It's not to be anything. It could be k to be a, k and n to be whatever you want. There's a set parameters you could now feel free to set. And let's pick n to be bigger than k. But for any n bigger than k, you can look at this code. And then you can ask what is the rate, what is the distance. And these will be functions of n and k. And then you can for your whatever application you want, it might make sense to suitably choose it. But if you choose, this is for any n and k, you can talk about this way of transforming symbols of length k to strings of length n. It gives you a code. So this is some parameters. The message length was k, the code word length was n, the alphabet size needed to be bigger than n. The rate is k over n, for whatever k and n you picked. What's the distance of the code? So that's the main important parameter which we don't know. We took this code, it's only going to be good if the distance is good. So what is the distance of this code? It turns out that these codes have amazing distance. So at least in this large alphabet setting, if your rate is k over n, these codes will give you the best possible distance that any code can give. So the only downside is that the alphabet is large, and so you have to make it binary, and maybe there's some loss in that. But if you're willing to work with high alphabet, this code gives you the best possible rate distance figure. Yes?
So what's q?
The size of the field. Integers mod p as integers mod q. So yeah, that was the key. Okay. Whatever the alphabet, underlying alphabet, which was the size of this finite field. If it was integers mod q, then the size of the field is size q. And q needed to be large because I needed n distinct elements in my field. So the whatever prime number I start with had to be larger than n. So this was a code with large alphabet. Now there are techniques of taking this and maybe encoding it further into binary by writing each alphabet symbol and binary messages away. So I won't get into that. For now, just let's go through this large alphabet. In this large alphabet, these codes have amazing distance. And let's see why they have such amazing distance. And so the key mathematical tool which we use to argue the distance. This is a very basic fact, that if you have a non-zero polynomial of degree d, it can have at most d zeros. Degree d polynomials can have at most d roots. So they can evaluate to zero at most d points. This is a basic fact about polynomials. This is the only fact that is used. Since a degree d polynomial, so in particular, our messages were degree k minus 1 polynomials. Degree k minus 1 polynomials can be 0 at most k minus 1 locations. Equivalently, if you have two different degree k minus 1 polynomials, at how many locations could their values agree? At most k minus 1. Because if they agree too often, then their difference polynomial, their difference would be 0 too many times. Does that make sense? Since a degree d polynomial can have at most d zeros, two degree d polynomials can be equal at most d times. So two degree k minus 1 polynomials can have at most k minus, they can be equal at most k minus 1 locations. And equivalently, two distinct code words can agree in at most k minus 1 locations. So they're equal in at most k minus 1 locations, they have to be unequal in the remaining locations, which is n minus k plus 1. So the distance of the Reed Solomon code is n minus k plus 1. If you want the fractional distance, you just divide by n. And it's n minus k plus 1 divided by n. And that's great because, for instance, one setting of parameters is n equal to 2k. Okay, you get rate half, and the distance is also half, roughly half.
So this notion of distance is only counting the fact that the values are not the same.
Right.
But in finite precision arithmetic, even if two values are not exactly the same in exact arithmetic, I can still compute them to be the same. So it seems that this is not taking that into account at all.
Because you need finite precision.
Right. One plus epsilon for epsilon sufficiently small, like less than 10 to the negative 15.
Right.
Will be 1.
So you're saying if you have two, yeah, so one thing we're assuming is that when you write down the symbols of this alphabet, each symbol is either corrupt or not corrupt. If it's not corrupt, then we're able to read it completely correctly without any error.
So you must be making some assumption, right? Are we only dealing with integers here?
The finite here.
These are mathematical integers, right?
Everything's discrete.
But these are mathematical integers, right? Not bit precise or like.
I don't care what bit. These are not such big integers, also, right? These are log n integers. N, whatever your finite field is size, right? You put the prime whose length is larger than n. And you're going mod b. So every you write down only integers. And every integer is, you want to write it down as bits, then it's about log n bits. And there's no precision. And now it gets corrupted or not corrupted. There's no, if there were bits that would make you happy, which is zeros and ones, and the bit can either get flipped or not.
Well, I come from a world where representation matters a lot. Okay. So if you are working on an exact discrete world, it's better.
Yeah, so right on, everything exact discrete. And things either get corrupt or not corrupt, and as a whole. What is not corrupt, it gets completely so these codes, which have this rate distance trade-off, and it's not hard to show that you cannot hope to get better rate distance trade-off. This is the best possible. These have already, they're already widely used in practice, in actual DBD storage and a ton of applications everywhere. We use Reed Solomon codes are used. And it turns out that the encoding and decoding algorithms, so decoding is once you have a corrupted code word or a corrupted degree D polynomial recovering the true degree D polynomial. That problem also has an extremely efficient encoding decoding algorithms and tons of applications. And I won't talk too much about this, but these are already very good. Maybe I turn the question around a little bit. So let me ask, let's demand something even more of our codes. So imagine that the amount of data we have is really massive. And we want to use the same Shannon architecture, take this entire data, store it, and get corrupted, we want to recover it. And if you have large data, this entire scheme still works. But if you have a lot of information that you want to encode, for instance, via this polynomial scheme, then the decoding time can still be prohibitively large. For instance, I have this entire, I have an entire dictionary, and I want to encode it by an error correcting code. And at the end, I want to find out the meaning of one word. Do I need to decode everything to recover this tiny piece of information I want? Or can I do more efficiently? So this is motivating the topic of sublinear time algorithms, where sometimes you have data which might be huge, but you want to work with it in time much smaller than the size of the data. So this is going to apply to the decoding algorithm. So you have this entire information which you've encoded and you stored in a DBD, and now I want to recover just one sector of a DBD. And to recover the true value of what was written in one sector, do I need to decode the entire thing, or can I work much more efficiently and hope to recover it in much less time and still hope for high reliability? And this notion of being able to recover a tiny portion of the message without even looking at the entire code, right? This can be formalized as a locally decodable code. It's local. It can get local information much more efficiently. So classic codes, they read and process the entire corrupted code word to even recover a single symbol of the message. But a locally decodable code will look at this corrupted code word in very few locations and try to recover any symbol of the original message. So let me define and motivate locally decodable codes. I'll tell you a little bit of what is not, and I'll tell you a little bit about some recent work on this topic. Classical codes, this was a corrupted code word where the amount of errors wasn't too many. So the distance of your corrupted code word from your true code word was something tiny. Then the classical decoding algorithm would look at the entire thing, process it, and tell you what the message is. But a locally decodable code, again, you give it a corrupted code word which is without not too many errors, and then the decoding algorithm will say, tell me which symbol of the message you want. Yeah, I'll say I want only the ith symbol of the message. The decoding algorithm will look at very few locations and tell me, look, this is what MI is, the ith symbol of the message. And one caveat is the following. We can only hope to do this with high probability, with maybe very high probability, but you can't hope to do this always. And the reason is the following. If to recover the ith symbol, the local decoder was going to look at some 10 locations, what if those locations were precisely the locations that were corrupt? Then, of course, you're going to output a wrong answer. There's no hope of recovering it. So I want to be able to do this with maybe 99.999% accuracy. And then there's still hope in this. If I want to recover the true value of any symbol, really high probability, so high that it won't affect my life, it's good enough for most practical purposes, then one can still hope that such objects exist.
And crucially, you mean with high probability for every eye.
For every eye, no matter which eye you want. There shouldn't be some eyes which are just completely unrecoverable. But no matter what eye you give me, with 99.99999% probability, I want to be able to recover the true value MI by looking at very few locations.
But which, if you look at the entire message, you could actually decode it. Is that?
If you look at the entire message, you can always decode it, because that's the classical decoding algorithm for it. But you want to be able to do this by looking at much fewer symbols than the entire message.
Sure.
And you can talk about what does much fewer mean. Can you get away by just looking at 100 locations? Can you get away by looking at square root of the length locations? One can look at different, again, parameters and see what can one achieve. But there's a whole range of parameters in which you can ask this question. There's the query complexity, which is how many locations do you need? And then there's the distance and the rate. So another parameter which we introduce is the query complexity. And so you can ask for locally decodable codes and ask what kind of query complexity. There's another notion of, I don't want to get too much into it, locally correctable codes, which instead of recovering the true symbol of the message, can recover the true symbols of the underlying code word. So you give it some location I in 1 through n, and it will tell you the I symbol of the underlying code word. Very related, but let's not get in. It's very, very closely related, but let's not bother about the difference. And this notion of locally decodable codes has had many applications to theoretical computer science, so cryptography and complexity theory, learning theory. We've seen lots of applications, mathematically very interesting, and very, very recently, it seems very practically motivated, the question of being able to deal with big quantities of data, like querying it in very few locations. And just through the last few years, there's been applications of this and variations of this in practice. So this is a very promising area to pursue, to see how far one can push it in practical applications.
So the original, at the beginning of the talk, you showed the simple coding.
Yeah. That is locally decodable, yes. Because you just look at what few locations to recover, but with very poor rate distance trade-off. But yes, that we don't have to read the whole thing there. So yes. And actually, maybe
except even there, if you just you know, if those 10 bits are the ones that are erased,
there's no
hope. And you're hoping for something much better than that.
Right. So there, the amount of error you could deal with is really tiny. So you would deal with constant number of errors as opposed to constant fraction of errors. But the distance of that code is really, really bad. Here, you're hoping to have 1% of all of the locations, so n over 100 locations corrupted and still recovered. So the kind of guarantees we're looking for are much, much larger. So let me tell you what is known. So let me give you an example of a code with pretty bad rate, but still has amazing local decoding properties. Okay, so this is the Hadamard code. Many of you might have seen Hadamard matrices or Hadamard code in various guises. So let me tell you what the Hadamard code is. So just like this, you took up in this this big finite field, the Reed-Muller code, you took your message, interpreted it as a polynomial, and your code word was evaluations of this polynomial. For the Hadamard code, again, you take your message. Now we are bits, 0, 1. The message is zeros and ones. You have a message of length k. You interpret it as the coefficient of a linear function. If your message is 1, a1, a2, up to ak, you interpret it as the following linear function over f2, so everything mod 2. a1x1 plus a2x2, a2xk. So it's a k-variate linear function. So you take your data, interpret it as like that, and your encoding map is take this linear function and evaluate it on all of 0, 1 to the n, 0, 1 to the k. For every possible choosing of x1, x2, to xk, 0, 1 values, the 2 to the k ways you can set x1 through xk. For every setting of those, you take this function, evaluate that, and write down this entire string of length 2 to the k. That's the Hadamard code. And amazingly, it turns out to be locally decodable with just 2 queries. And I don't want to spend too much time on it, but it's just think about it for a minute, all of you will see that if I look at this linear function, evaluated it at any point x, and the linear function evaluated at any point x plus ei. Like ei is a vector with 1 in the ith location and zeros elsewhere. You take the sum, you will recover exactly ai, which was the ith symbol of the message. Now, of course, I could have gone and corrupted exactly, I corrupted either this or I corrupted that, then there's no hope of recovering this. I won't recover what ai is. Where I queried was corrupt. But this, the relationship holds no matter what choice of what x is. So the way the decoding would work is pick a random x. And then query the code word at the location x and the location x plus e. And if x is random, we're basically querying a uniformly random location of the code word. If the number of errors is small, then the location you query will be uncorrupted with very high probability. Similarly, you can show that this will also be uncorrupted with very high probability, and so both will be correct with very high probability, and so it can recover what AI is with very high probability. Turns out we locally decode, 2 query locally decodable code. Very poor rate because you have to blow up this message exponentially. K symbols, K bits got blown up with 2 to the K bits. So the rate is poor, but we know that if you want to get 2 query locally decodable codes, you can't hope to do better. The rate needs to be like that. You need to do this blow up. Why did we work with linear polynomials? Let's try to generalize this. This whole family of codes called Reed-Muller codes. Which instead of working with linear polynomials, works with higher degree polynomials. Okay, so let's try to generalize both the Solomon codes and the Hadamard codes. So this was univariate high degree polynomials. What we just talked about was degree one, but many variate polynomials. Let's combine them both. Let's look at high degree polynomials in many variables and do the same thing. Yes?
Does Reed-Solomon have any non-trivial
No. Sound very low. Okay, so reading Muller codes, so let's take polynomials of degree D in n variables. B and m are again parameters, you can tune it to be whatever you want. When D was 1, we basically got Hadamard, when m was 1, we got Greek solid. So now let D and m be both be high. You take your message, you treat it to be the coefficients of such a polynomial. Your evaluations, I take this polynomial, evaluate it everywhere. You just, and then you work out the parameters. See what is the code word length, what is the message length, what is the distance, what is the rate, is it locally decodable? You can ask all these questions. And it turns out that these codes have a very well studied, have pretty good parameters. So you worked out. So we quickly say, so you take your data polynomial of some degree, evaluate this polynomial. Suppose it's for simplicity, suppose you had only a polynomial in two variables. Then when you take this polynomial and you evaluate it on all of fq cross fq, fine. At every point in your fq cross fq, you write down the value of the polynomial. Just like polynomials of degree D can have at most D zeros, there's a bivariate analog of this theorem which will tell you that these codes have good distance. That's nice. The advantage of these Riemann-Muller codes is that they also turn out to be locally decodable, just like the Hadamard code, but with much better rate distance trade-offs. And let me quickly tell you why they're locally decodable. So don't read all this, just look at the picture and listen to what I'm saying. Your code work is there were the true values you've written down, and then some corruptions. Some blobs, there were some locations which got corrupted, we don't know what those locations are. I want to now recover the true value at any point. Okay? How do I do that? I'll pass a random line to that point. If overall the corruptions are small, then on a random line from the point, I won't see too many corruptions on the line. So I'll pass a random line and I'll read all the points which lie on the line. If I have a bivariate polynomial and you restrict to a line, looks like a univariate polynomial. So when I read all the values on a line, what I see is values of a corrupted univariate polynomial, because some locations are corrupted. So given values of a corrupted univariate polynomial, recover the true underlying univariate polynomial. That's exactly Reed-Solomon decoding, which we already know how to do. By looking at this, I can recover the true value of this polynomial on the line, and then I can just evaluate it at a comma b and recover the true value. So that's how the decoding would work. Pass a random line and do the decoding along the line. And the reason it has this locality property is we didn't read the whole code word. We only read the values on the line. So we read much fewer locations than the entire code word. So we got away by reading much less. And this is over fq cross fq. So if you in two dimensions, when I read a line, I read square root of the amount of information of the code word length. But I could have done this over three dimensions. In three dimensions, the same thing. When I read values on a line, I read 1 over cube root. I read cube root amount of information. In m variables, I read even less information. So that's how these codes get their locality properties. And you can
So that would still be a bit high probability.
It's still high probability. Whenever we do local decoding, there's just no chance of doing it with probability 1. Because to be able to decode this value with probability 1, it means no matter what queries I make, I should always be able to recover the true value. But what if I just corrupted? Because I have no idea where the corruptions occur. There's an adversary who's making these corruptions. I have no control over where the corruptions occur. And so any person who knows my algorithm would just go corrupt exactly those locations. And so there's no chance. So out here, the only bad case is if my line has too many errors. But most lines will not have too many errors.
Another question I had was, does the sampling need to be uniform?
It needs to be uniform, yeah. Because if I just look at few lines, then I might be able to corrupt all these lines. I might be able to place my errors so that the lines are all corrupted. But if I take a uniformly random line, then...
Well, there's a
choice of the line, and then there's sampling of the coins on the line.
So what we ended up doing was get all the coins on the line.
Okay, all the coins.
We include all the coins on the line, because so that is the way we chose parameters, you needed all that information to be able to recover the value of the all. You can think of getting a little bit less information, but at least the way I set it up, we actually equated every node in that.
So as k increases, this would be going to become a lot of variables.
When you set up parameters, the way you wrote your code word, what is a two-dimensional array, then the number of queries you make into the code word is 1/2. One line out of a two-dimensional.
Right.
If you arrange your code word to be three-dimensional, then the number of queries would be one line out of a three-dimensional. So I can suitably choose parameters by making this polynomial m dimensions. So the length is n, one line is n to the 1/n. Amount of information. So it's not going to be two queries or three queries, but it will still be a really tiny fraction of the code word. So these are not going to be this constant number of queries, it will be larger number of queries, but it will still be.
But we still haven't gotten to her work.
So these are the malicodes, you work out the parameters. And you see, so this is a bivariate example I gave, where rate turns out to be something like half, and the query complexity turns out to be something like square root. To improve the query complexity, you increase the number of variables. You tune parameters and you can improve it. You increase the number of variables, the rate, so you make it m variate polynomials, and you work out the parameters, the rate turns out to be 1/m, and the query complexity is something like k^1. M is a parameter in your hand. So for every m, you can achieve this trade-off. Rate being something like 1/m, query complexity being k^1. And for a long time, maybe 7-8 years ago, people didn't know how to do better than Riemann codes. These were the best codes we knew. These were the only locally decoded codes that we knew. And I can ask, can you do better? And then there are two regimes you can do it. One is the constant queries. I want locally decodable code which is two queries or three queries. You can ask, can you do better than Hadamard or the analogs? And you talk about high rate regimes, where I want the rate. Look, I want to be a practical coding theorist. Rate is very important. I can't afford to even double the message. I want the rate to be at least a constant or pretty high. And now what's the best query complexity? You can study both regimes. The low query regime we know is going to be quite inefficient for practice. In practice, we need to focus on the high query regime. In the low query regime, we know how to do better than Riemann codes through a beautiful body of work called matching vector codes. But we still don't know the best rate distance trade-offs. Let me not talk about it. Let me focus on the high rate regime. Six to eight years ago, the Riemann codes were the only example we knew. Where we wanted to get query complexity k^ε. For any epsilon, the rate needed to be n needed to be exponential in 1/ε times k. So we wanted the rate to be k^110, n needed to be maybe 1,000 times k. And then recently, so this is one of the works I wanted to mention, joint work with Stasny Kopaty and Sergey Kanin, and then there was many subsequent works. We now know how to construct codes high rate, really close to 1. So the amount of redundancy is almost nothing. So you can get rate 1 - ε and query complexity k^ε. For instance, you set epsilon to be 1/10, you can achieve query complexity k^110 and rate really close to 1.
Which is a dramatic improvement.
For the first time, you can get local codes with rate being pushed all the way to 1. Riemann codes, you couldn't even hope for rate more than half. It was just prior to this work, there were no codes with rate greater than half which had any locality. These give you rates now all the way pushed up to 1 with locality, and you can push the locality down. And they can recover from a constant fraction of errors. So the number of errors you can deal with is something like some function, maybe epsilon squared n, for whatever epsilon you pick.
Okay, just to make sure I'm parsing it correctly, as you make epsilon smaller, you're making fewer queries, and your rate is getting better.
So make this epsilon 1 and epsilon 2. And you can make both of them really small. What you're paying for is the amount of errors you can, the fraction of errors you can do.
Epsilon is a free parameter. It's
epsilon
not
is a free parameter. Okay. Epsilon is a free parameter. Make it whatever you want. Make it as small as you want. The rate gets really good. Query complexity gets really good. You got to pay somewhere, because by far might not be epsilon 0. And where you pay for it is in the fraction of errors you can handle. It will still be a constant fraction, and the constant will depend on epsilon. So I think it's epsilon squared n. Whatever epsilon you can pick, right here, the number of errors you can deal with is epsilon squared times n.
And the error rate is sort of not the focus.
It's a constant fraction, it's a constant. If you want to get a constant fraction of errors, so in all these prior settings also, if you want to be able to deal with a constant fraction of errors, then you can get away with making k be any constant in the query complexity and the rate to be 1 minus any constant.
But the other place that you're paying is how much work you have to go through in order to actually implement it.
Right.
The runtime or just the ideas?
Well, I mean, if...
Not really. The decoding algorithm is going to be some, probably too much more than k to the epsilon. The poly k to the epsilon. So actually you can make epsilon quite small and still have very efficient I think we only pay
the
error rate.
So the polynomial doesn't depend on epsilon at all?
No.
Okay.
You pay in the fraction of errors. Because you're going to decode on the line, right? You're going to use query points. It's going to be similar to the read-mother decoding, where you query points in the line and univariate decoding on the line. And so you query these points and then do some work on those points. It's not much work. So it's pretty efficient in forming decoding, and you pay in the fraction of errors. Rate, there will be some function of epsilon times n. If n is huge, the number of errors you tolerate is still quite large.
Even if the algorithm is not efficient, there would be some kind of a natural trade-off, like a structural trade-off way.
So I'm paying, right? But if I make epsilon small, I am paying.
Right. That paying doesn't come in common. It's not necessarily related to the efficiency of the algorithm,
right,
but necessarily the structure of our system. Because you can't have rate and query complexity low and still continue to not pay.
Right. So I'm paying the amount of errors I can tolerate. So that's the code gets worse, and the smaller you make epsilon, the distance of the code gets smaller as a function. And let me just basically out of time. Let me just give you the idea of how these codes are constructed. It's basically the Reed-Muller codes, where you take these polynomial codes and you just evaluate them. These codes are taking these Reed-Muller codes and augment them with the notion of a derivative. So you take, when you pick a large finite field, you interpret your message to be a polynomial, the coefficients of a polynomial. But now somehow we believe parameters be chosen such that you can get away with higher degree polynomials. And the encoding will be take a polynomial, don't just evaluate it at a point, but evaluate the polynomial and its x derivative and its y derivative. And somehow by doing that, I don't have time to say much more, it turns out to still have the same properties of Reed-Muller code, good distance, locally decodable, correctable, everything. But the rate turns out to be dramatically better. Just the act of also writing the derivatives down, then you can get the way the trade-offs work. Since in short distance you can work with higher degree polynomials means messages can be larger. Messages can be larger means k can be larger than what previously could. And that's what allows, and we just do the calculation, the ratio between k and n turns out to be much. So just a comparison between Reed-Muller and multiplicity. These were messages were low degree polynomials, lowish degree polynomials. Here you can get away with messages being much higher degree polynomials. The here you're evaluating the polynomials everywhere, here you're evaluating the polynomials and its derivatives everywhere. So the basic example was when you evaluated the x derivative and the y derivative. So even more improvement, you evaluate not only the first derivatives, but also the second derivatives and the third derivatives and so on and so forth. The query complexity decreases when you increase variables in both places. Here the rate decreases when you increase the number of variables. But somehow here, by evaluating enough derivatives, the trade-off works in your favor and you can push the rate to 1. I'd be happy to talk with anybody more about details of the proof, since I really didn't get too much time to talk about it. But there's been follow-up work since then with Swastik, Orr, and Noga, where we improve upon multiplicity codes to drive the query complexity down much smaller. So instead of k to the epsilon, we get 2 to the root log k log log k, which is a much better function. It starts, so let me give you how it works. You start with a multiplicity code, you chop it up into pieces, blow up each piece by Reed-Solomon code, and then impose some random graph on this code where to rearrange the inputs. Quick sketch of, you take this multiplicity code and you do some processing to the code work in this fashion, and it turns out to now suddenly have much better graphs. This intermediate resolvement and this random graph on top of it drives the query down, query complexity down even further. You analyze it. That's what it takes to decode them. Everything is done locally. And you can make the alphabet binary if you don't like big alphabets. And so now out of time, but again, I'm very happy to take questions and talk to anybody after this. And it's the, we know that if you want to have really high rate, you can't hope to have high rate and a constant number of codes. This we know. But one could hope to have high rate and log n queries. We don't know that one cannot get away with this. That's a big hope. So we achieve something like 2 to the root log n queries. One would hope to get all the way down to log n queries. We don't really know what the true answer is. Can you yet construct even better codes with much fewer query complexity, or is there some reason for which this is not possible?
And do you have the suspicion?
I think we should be able to do better than what we did. So our final thing was so, I mean, you take it, chop it, read mother, mix it up, sounded a bit, it may not be the best you can do, so I suspect you can do much better, but I also don't think you can find the answer somewhere. I don't know what it is. Each time we constructed this new family of codes, it came as a big surprise. Reed Muller codes were conjectured to be the best. So when these multiplicity codes came out, it came as a big surprise that it was even possible. And then we conjectured those were the best. And then these new ones surprised us as well. We could do better. So I'm not sure. So I think we can. This is not the best. Thank you.
So we'll throw the floor open to questions.